Geekscape.com. Ancient Eugenics by Alan G. Roper. The preface to A History of Eugenics may be compiled from barbarism, for the first eugenicist was not the Spartan legislator, but the primitive savage who killed his sickly child. The cosmic process was checked and superseded by another, as ruthless as nature's own method of elimination. The lower the community, the more rapidly it reproduces itself. There is an extravagant production of raw material, and the way of nature, red in tooth and claw, is the ruthless rejection of all that is superfluous. When there is no differential birth rate, the result of foresight and self-control, and the attainment of a higher level of civilization, nature adjusts the balance by means of a differential death rate. In the days when human or animal foe threatened on every side, when force and fraud were the two cardinal virtues, and the life of man was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, natural selection must have been ruthless and severe. Some conception of the wasteful processes of nature dawned upon the savage mind. While they lived their short lives, the weakly, the deformed, and the superfluous were a burden to the tribe. Human law, superseding natural law, strove to eliminate them at birth. This was the atavistic basis on which subsequent eugenics were built. In Greece, the theory underwent a logical development. Even in a later age of dawning civilization, war confronted men with this same problem of the ruthless extermination of the unfit. It was recognized that the occurrence of the non-viable child was inevitable, but remedial legislation, reaching a step further back, essayed by anticipation to reduce this waste of life to a minimum. It was realized that to increase the productivity of the best stock is a more important measure than to repress the productivity of the worst. Out of the negative aspect of eugenics develops the positive. With the advance of civilization, conditions become increasingly stable. War is still imminent, but instead of being an essential element of existence, it is regarded as a necessary evil. Nature, forging additional weapons, hastens the elimination of the unfit by disease. Some form of eugenics is still necessary, but in the altered conditions, a new ideal is born. The conception of a race of warriors merges into the ideal of a state of healthy citizens. All these formulations of eugenics are aristocratic and parochial. They are to benefit the people of a single state and only a section within that state. Any wider conception of racial regeneration was impossible to a people who dichotomized the state into free citizens and living instruments, the world into Greeks and barbarians. The breakdown of the city-states brought a cosmopolitanism, which instead of widening the ideal of humanity, centered itself on the interests of the individual. Modern eugenics is based on evolution. Not a passive form, but one that concedes some latitude to the guiding action of the human will. Without some such postulate, egotism becomes a rational creed amidst the social welter and world weariness of a deliquescent civilization. Man is cut off sharply and definitely from all that went before and all that follows. Only the isolated ego remains, a sort of complementary nirvana, and the philosophy of ikshut, of self-centered individualism, ends in hedonism or ascetic alienation from an inexplicable universe. No scheme of social reform can bear fruit in such an atmosphere of philosophic negation. Like Plato's philosopher, man shelters from the tempest behind the wall. Three conceptions of the cosmic process are possible. We may maintain that there is no such thing as progress, that life is a mere pointless reiteration of age after age, till there comes the predestined cataclysm. We may believe in a primeval age of innocence and happiness, a golden age, or a state of nature, diabolomon ideal. Finally, we may trust in the gradual evolution of mankind towards a terrestrial paradise, hoping that, on our heels, a fresh perfection treads, a power more strong in beauty, born of us, and fated to excel us as we pass in glory that old darkness. This conception of man as heir of all the ages, although vaguely anticipated by Anaximander, was impossible to an age which knew nothing of biology. No system of eugenics is likely to flourish side by side with the belief in an unprogressive or degenerate humanity, steadily and inevitably declining from primordial perfection. So long as the city-state survived, patriotism prevailed over pessimism, and ideals of regeneration were more than the idle dreams of the philosopher. But the growing prominence assigned to the theoretic life shows the gradual growth of despair. After Aristotle, eugenics takes its place among the forgotten ideals of the past. But a thought, or a theory, which has once quickened into life, becomes immortal. It may change its form, but it never perishes. Throughout time, it is ceaselessly renewing its existence. While infanticide is everywhere disappearing, there remain still the principles simultaneously developed. 3 centuries ago, eugenics was the utopian dream of an imprisoned monk. A century later, Steele, more in jest than in earnest, suggested that one might wear any passion out of a family by culture, as skilful gardeners blot a colour out of a tulip that hurts its beauty. But neither science nor public opinion was ready to respond. It was not until late in the 19th century that the crude human breeding of the Spartans, in altered form and in new conditions, became the scientific stirpiculture of Galton. To read the small minuscule of ancient eugenics, it is expedient first to scan the uncules of modern theory. Beneath the new form engendered by altered conditions, with the unessential and accidental passing away into other combinations, there remains an essential identity of form. History can only be an attempted interpretation of earlier ages by the modes of thought current in our own. The foreground of human life we can see with exactness, but the past is foreshortened by the atmosphere of time. Under the modern conditions of civilization, elimination by international or individual violence is steadily decreasing. Nature has found an equally effective weapon in the process of urbanization. Disease spreads rapidly amid conditions inimical in the highest degree to healthy living. But while infanticide forms the basis on which the ancient system was built, the abolition of that practice has been the starting point for the new eugenics. It has confronted us with problems unknown to a pre-Christian age. The ancients attempted to combat the wasteful processes of nature by eliminating the non-viable at birth. Our efforts, on the contrary, have been directed to the prolongation of their lives. Instead of sacrificing the unfit in the interests of the fit, we have employed every resource of modern science to keep alight the feeble flame of life in the base-born child of a degenerate parent. The weapons forged by nature have been taken from her hands. Side by side with the rapid multiplication of the unfit, there has been a marked decline in the birth rate of the useful classes of the community. The relatively strongest survive, but their strength has suffered from the influences which brought extinction to the weaker. This is one of the problems caused by a humaner sentiment. In the second place, the abolition of infanticide has confronted us with the necessity of knowledge. The methods of the breeder are ruthless and precise. He slaughters or he spares, and divergent variations are a matter of no moment. So the Spartans and Plato, with this analogy before them, were saved from the necessity of any deeper knowledge by the preventive check of infanticide. If nature erred in her intentions, this art was at hand to rectify her mistakes. Infanticide saved the Greeks from the problems of heredity. For all practical purposes, our knowledge is as infinitesimal as in the days of Plato. The methods of biometry and statistics, the actuarial side of heredity, deal merely with the characteristics of groups. Mendelism, dealing with the individual, finds verification in man only in the case of feeble-mindedness and in the inheritance of certain deformities. Any constructive scheme of eugenics is impossible under the limitations of our knowledge. Apart from the question of heredity, there is the problem of selection. Though physique is easily estimated and correlated, perhaps, as Galton held, with other good qualities, the modern eugenicist has before him no simple homogeneous ideal. He has to recognize the psychical as well as the physical aspect of the intricate mosaic of human personality. The self-sacrificers and the self-tormentors claim their place no less than a Marcus Aurelius or an Adam Bede. Even though we hold it possible to compile a list of qualities for selection universally acceptable, we cannot, under the present limitations of our knowledge, prove personal value to be synonymous with reproductive value. No scheme of economic eugenics, inferring the aptitudes of individuals from social position or income, can solve the hopeless perplexities that wait upon constructive methods. Passing from the municipality to the world, eugenics is confronted by the conflicting ideals not only of alternative characters, but also of incompatible civilizations. Since differentiation is an indispensable factor in human progress, there arises the further problem of a eugenic ethnology. This, then, is the shape modern theory has assumed in answer to the demands of modern civilization. Lost in egotism, eugenics found opposition no less formidable in a spirit of imprudent altruism. Only the scientific altruism of today has rendered it once more practicable. From its origin, in the unreflective intuition of the atavistic past, we will trace the growth of the theory till it passed into the pages of Aristotle and became lost to view amidst the throes of a pessimistic and decadent age. Infanticide and exposure, terms which in early ages were virtually synonymous, appear on first consideration to have been practiced among uncivilized tribes for a bewildering multiplicity of reasons. There is the female infanticide of China and the isles of the southern Pacific, the male infanticide of the Epiphanes of Paraguay, and the indiscriminate massacre of the Gargas, who, killing every child alike, steal from a neighbouring tribe. There are the Indians, who offer up children to Moloch, or drown them in the Ganges. The Carthaginians sacrifice them to Kronos, the Mexicans to the rain god. There is the murder of twins and albinos in Arebo, and the cannibalism of the Aborigines. In Mingrelia, when they have not the wherewithal to maintain them, they hold it a piece of charity to murder infants newborn. There are the Baluki, who kill all their natural children, and there is the modern factor of shame. Coexisting with all these various practices, there is the definitely eugenic motive. Among the Aborigines, all deformed children are killed as soon as born. The savages of Guyana kill any child that is deformed, feeble, or bothersome. The Fans kill all sickly children. In Central America, it is suspected that infant murder is responsible for the rarity of the deformed. In Tonquin, we hear of a law which forbids the exposing or strangling of children, be they ever so deformed. In Japan, deformed children were killed or reared according to the father's pleasure. Among the Prussians, the aged and infirm, the sick and deformed, were unhesitatingly put to death. The question arises, therefore, whether the eugenic motive first led to the institution of infanticide, or whether it was merely a by-product, a later growth, springing out of a practice which owed its inception to totally different causes. Setting aside infanticide when prompted by mere brutality or cannibalistic cravings, and excluding the modern factor of shame, which was unknown among primitive peoples, the motives may be classified as irrational or rational. Irrational motives are the religious or superstitious, rational the eugenic. Between these two, there is a wide line of demarcation. The origin of religious infanticide is obscure. It may be merely evidence of fiendish passion. There may be in it something of a sacramental meal, or possibly the primal idea in its many variations is the gain of some benefit by the sacrifice of something of value. In any case, whatever the basic intentions, the religious motive in infanticide has no relation to the eugenic. Such melancholy theology implies some degree of social organization, and was therefore a later and independent conception. Only some powerful and long-continued pressure could have brought about the reversal of sentiments, which must have been innate in primitive man as much as in other animals. The impelling sources were two, want and war, or both in combination, not want in the form of famine, which, working its own cure, not infrequently leaves an increased prosperity behind it, nor war as brief and desolating in its effects as warfare of today, but rather that long enduring warfare, pressing on generation after generation, which is the state of hostility. This was the normal state of early man, a condition of affairs inseparable from independent life in small communities. Jacob and Esau go their separate ways, form different habits and different languages, and estrangement follows, inevitably. Even before man became his own worst enemy, brute creation must have furnished formidable foes to the naked and defenceless savage. There must have been pending want at this early stage of life. Under pressure of want, the group must adjust their numbers to the available food. Under pressure of war, the same problem rises in still more urgent form. From these circumstances arises the practice of infanticide. It is circumstance, says Plato, and not man, which makes the laws. The nomadic group, passing from district to district in search of food, would find their children a burden. The first infanticides, casual rather than premeditated, were in the nature of a desertion. This, preparing the way for an extension of the practice, would lead to its adoption in the attempt to adjust numbers to the available food supply. In the same way non-combatants would be regarded in the nature of impedimenta, since they consumed food without benefiting the group in return. The first system of infanticide is, therefore, a policy of despair. The first victims would probably be the deformed, the maimed, and the weaklings, and female infanticide would follow. The problem of the maintenance of the race arising would lead to male infanticide whenever there was a deficiency of women. Hence the custom, so far from being merely callous and brutal, and an argument for man's inferiority to the beast, is a proof of the highest intelligence. These barbaric eugenics, therefore, eliminating at birth those foredoomed to perish in the struggle for existence, were concerned with questions both of quantity and quality. Limitation of numbers, though it does not itself constitute a generation of the race, improves to a considerable degree the individuals of which the race is constituted. When the undesired children are out of the way, more attention can be paid to the desired. The savage bred recklessly, compensating his recklessness by infanticide, but a natural law of civilization has superseded the artificial law of primitive man. Control of reproduction, and resulting from it a falling birth rate and a diminished death rate, is a tendency which, first showing itself in Imperial Rome, is conspicuous today in every civilized community.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.